Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibe. This week on Culturetopia, a look at how comedy changed in response to 9/11, how a tech whiz became a media guru for rapper Lil Wayne, and the song of the summer of 2011. But first,
fans of the TV medical drama House know actor Hugh Laurie as the sardonic, limping, Vicodin-popping title character, Dr. Gregory House.
What would you want? A doctor who holds your hand while you die, or a doctor who ignores you while you get better? I guess it would particularly suck to have a doctor who ignores you while you die.
Well, now a different side of Hugh Laurie, the Englishman with a deep passion for New Orleans and Delta blues. On his debut album, titled Let Them Talk, he's romping through the music he loves best, with his piano playing front and center.
I wanted to appear, if you don't mind me saying, I wanted to appear naked. Of course, I am surrounded by wonderful, wonderful musicians. I didn't want to hide behind them. I wanted to sort of come out and just appear as sort of nakedly and honestly as I could and say, well, this is me doing this. This is what it's going to be. This is what I love, and this is how it sounds. And take it or leave it. Well, take it. Please don't leave it.
I went down to St. James Infirmary.
You start the liner notes for the CD with just a bald disclaimer. You say, I was not born in Alabama in the 1890s. You may as well know this now. I've never eaten grits, cropped a share, or ridden a boxcar.
Yes.
All true.
All true. Although by the reference to the 1890s, I was slyly trying to make it clear that actually no one currently making records was born in the 1890s. But yes, I'm perfectly well aware of the fact that I'm not conventionally qualified to play this music. It's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to make a blues record.
But you've done it.
Well, I've done my best. I've done my best.
Put a $20 gold piece on my watch chain, so the boys will know I died standing pat.
Well, Hugh Laurie, how far back does that love for the blues go for you?
Really, as long as I can remember. But that's not saying much, because I can't remember more than about an hour ago. But when I was a small boy, 10, 11, 12, probably somewhere around there, and I first heard a blues song on the radio, it was a jolt of electricity. It grabbed me by the throat. It made me shiver, and I knew from that moment that this was for me and this would be with me for the rest of my life, and so it has proved to be. I've never really moved on, but then I haven't moved on from 10 years old in all kinds of ways. I know that.
So at the time that you heard that song, you already were a piano player, right? You started playing when you were a kid.
Well, no. I was driven at the point of a sharp stick through some token piano lessons, as lots of children are. I absolutely hated it. I actually went on hunger strike for 3 days, which again doesn't sound very long. That's not exactly suffering, is it? But, you know, at 10 or 12 probably.
That makes a statement, yeah.
Yeah, that 3 days is quite a long time. And then eventually my mother cracked, the warden cracked, and she allowed me to give up the piano. And I didn't come back to the piano till sort of late teens, and then just started fiddling about on my own.
Your version of the Stephen Foster song Swanee River, which we might think about as a really sort of melancholy lament, you turned it into this incredibly fun barrel house stomp.
We let rip, yeah.
And we hear you kind of cackling in there.
Hootin' and hollerin'. I was having a very good time. Couldn't hide it.
Yeah.
back in the far-off, distant past, when I was struggling through these piano lessons, which I didn't enjoy, the only song in the book that we were working from that I thought, well, even vaguely resembled a blues song was Swanee River. It kept me going. It was the oasis on the horizon, and we crawled across the desert of these awful French lullabies and polkas that you have to learn to get there. And when finally we arrived, and my piano teacher, she turned the page and she looked at it and she went, Negro spiritual, slightly syncopated. No, I think we'll need that.
Really?
And we skipped it. And that was the moment I knew that classical music was not for me. So this has always been with me, this song, for that reason.
I'm talking to the actor, Hugh Laurie. His new CD is Let Them Talk.
The actor-musician.
Actor-musician. Actor
well,
slash
or musician-actor.
Musician, one or the other.
I don't know. And underwear model. No, I'm not. That's not. I made that up.
I thought you were naked.
I am naked.
Have to read
I am
naked.
No, exactly.
Okay.
Thought I heard Buddy Bolden say, "You're nasty. You're dirty. Take it away. You're terrible. You're awful. Take it away."
Hugh Laurie, when you sing a swampy kind of song like Buddy Bolden's Blues, which has all these great vocal expressions in it, these voices that you're doing, I wonder if you're sort of diving into a character in sort of the same way that you might slip into the role of Dr. Gregory House on TV. Does it feel like that at all?
I suppose a little bit, but less conscious, I suppose. I feel when acting, I am sometimes overly self-conscious, I think, going, no, don't put your eyebrow back where it was, and no, turn to the left. And, you know, I'm sort of very consciously adopting this character. But with music, I don't know, I found it was a question of just closing my eyes and just sort of letting things come out. Acting is largely about putting on masks, and music is about removing them.
It sounds liberating, really.
It is. And actually, I do every day. The truth is, I get home after a day's work, acting and shouting and limping and pulling faces, and I go straight to the piano, and that's where I can sit for 10 minutes or 5 hours sometimes without even being aware of the time passing. It is immensely liberating. That's where I sort of let everything go.
Well, Hugh Laurie, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great talking to you.
And you can hear more of my conversation with Hugh Laurie and songs from his new album, Let Them Talk, at nprmusic.org.
1 week after the attacks of September 11th, 10 years ago, David Letterman faced the cameras. The late-night king of irony paid an earnest and heartfelt tribute to those who had died and those who died trying to save them.
And my hope for myself and everybody else, not only in New York but everywhere, is that we never, ever take these people for granted. Absolutely never take them for granted.
Many cultural commentators proclaimed the death of irony. Safe to say that didn't happen, but NPR's Neda Ulaby wondered how and if humor changed after 9/11.
On September 29th, 2001, Saturday Night Live aired its first show following thousands of deaths and the Twin Towers' fall. The mood was apprehensive. Would they pull it off?
From Studio 8H in Rockefeller Center, it's Weekend Update with Jimmy Fallon.
The writers and cast faced a dilemma. How do you joke after such a stunning attack?
U.S. officials continue the search for Osama bin Laden. Reports suggest that bin Laden is most likely hiding out somewhere remote and barren where he will not encounter others. The FBI has begun searching theaters showing the movie Glitter.
You can hear in that laughter a kind of relief. Professor Vivica Green just co-edited a book about humor after 9/11. She says a turning point came later in the show when then-mayor of New York, Rudolph Giuliani, took the stage with Saturday Night Live's creator, Lorne Michaels.
Lorne Michaels turns to Giuliani in a somewhat uncomfortable way, and he says, "Can we be funny?" And there's this awkward pause, and Giuliani says, "Why start now?"
Green was struck by Saturday Night Live asking for permission to be funny from a politician. Another comedian did not ask. When Gilbert Gottfried appeared on TV just a few days after the attacks, he intended to shock.
"Tonight I'm going to be using my Muslim name, Hasan bin Laid."
The audience did not laugh when Gottfried then kidded about an airplane making a connection at the Empire State Building. More recently, Gottfried got into trouble for mocking the tsunami in Japan the day after it happened.
There's that old saying, tragedy plus time equals comedy, and I always say, like, well, why wait?
Gilbert Gottfried, the king of too soon, says his mind just works that way.
See, to me, comedy and tragedy are roommates, and they're very strange roommates, but they're always together. And if tragedy's around, then comedy is not far behind. You know, if tragedy shows up, comedy is looking over its shoulder, sticking its tongue out.
Gottfried says at a moment fundamentally upsetting at what it means to be part of a human community, joking proves you've survived.
My reaction was business as usual.
It seems a little insensitive to me.
Professor Vivica Green says jokes in bad taste have a few things in common with irony. That explains all the talk about the end of irony after 9/11.
Irony has a reputation for being subversive and edgy, and it's often associated with cynicism.
Before 9/11, Green says irony was associated with a flip, throwaway kind of humor, like on Seinfeld, which took on such hot topics as macaroni, nose-picking, and yogurt.
"Hey, this yogurt is really something, huh? And it's non-fat! I've been waiting for something like this my whole life, and it's finally here!"
After 9/11, some young people started identifying with post-irony, including artist Brian Leo. At a little art gallery in New York City, about a mile from the former World Trade Center, Leo recently showed paintings evoking 9/11. Pop-inspired, candy-colored images of the Twin Towers, Osama bin Laden, even bodies falling. The show was called The Post-Ironic.
"It means that I'm being serious and sincere, and I'm not being ironic. So, I mean, that's pretty much what I was going for with that idea."
Post-irony is not the easiest idea to define. Broadly, it's about embracing what's genuine in a weirdly self-conscious way. But irony itself changed after 9/11. It turned from yogurt to politics. The Onion, Stephen Colbert, Dave Chappelle, Jon Stewart, here talking with 9/11 first responders as Congress debated a bill that would give them health benefits.
"Did you have to promise things to the other firefighters or the other policemen, like, just vote with us on this to go down to the towers to save people, and we'll do... we'll have chili on Friday night?"
Stewart's been given a lot of credit for getting that bill passed. And credit, too, for making humor since 9/11 something to take seriously. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Issa Rae and her character Jay is the star of the online web series The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. Here's a sample.
"Let me introduce myself. My name is Jay, and I'm awkward and black. Someone once told me those were the two worst things anyone could be. That someone was right."
Awkward Black Girl is part of a growing universe of television programs produced exclusively for the web. And some of those series have borrowed a page from public radio, getting fans to donate to keep the show alive. That gives a whole new definition of cliffhanger. When it looked like Awkward Black Girl wouldn't be able to finance new episodes, Ray sought viewer support on the fundraising website Kickstarter. Backers chipped in $56,000 and counting, well past the $40,000 goal, and enough to complete the remaining five episodes of Awkward Black Girl's first season. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called the girl herself, Issa Rae, and she's with us from our studios at NPR West. Welcome, and congratulations on everything.
Thank you so much. Thanks again for having me on the show. I'm having a fangirl moment.
Well, that's nice. Likewise. But you don't sound very awkward to me.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I fooled you.
So, of course, the question has to be asked is, you know, obviously one wants to know, how did you come up with the character of Jay? And I know it's such a cheap question, but is Jay you?
Jay is not me. She's an extension of me. I'm not as insecure as Jay, but I used to worry about what people thought of me all the time. I pretty much, just in creating her scenarios, I think about my own nightmare situations. What kind of situation would I hate to be in? What's the worst thing that could happen to me? What's the worst way I could behave in?
I think one of the appeal of the series is it's both universal and specific. I mean, it's universal in the sense that there are awkward moments that just about everyone has that you just think, what's going on here? Like there was the episode where you keep running into the same person at a stop sign on your way to work and you really don't want to talk to this person. On the other hand, there's some racial specificity that I'm interested in because it's not just the misadventures of an awkward girl, it's the misadventures of an awkward black girl. And I wanted to know how important is the racial element to you and how you conceive of the character and of the series.
I think the fact that she is black, but the concepts are universal, speaks volumes. Like, it shows that you can have a black, just because she's a black female lead doesn't mean you can't relate to her. And I think that that speaks more to mainstream media because there just is this sort of perception that, you know, if a black person is in the lead, then it has to be for black people. It has to only relate to them. And the fact that she goes through situations that we all go through is important. And I think she is awkward, not only in the sense because she is just, you know, socially inept in some situations, but also because she doesn't fit this mainstream black persona or archetype.
Well, she does go right there. I mean, the commentary, I think one of the things that people like about the series is that she just says what a lot of people are thinking. Or I'll just say it. Here's an example. I'm interested in whether some people think that some of her commentary is over the top. Like, for example, this is where, you know, Amir is one of the characters. And let's play a short clip of how you introduce him. Here it is.
Amir is the obnoxious, multiracial, self-appointed comedic relief of The Office.
And I was like, hello, I'm part Asian. I think I can calculate the totals.
He's ridiculously offensive, so my boss and Nina love him.
Where did that come from?
You know, you have a lot of people. I've met a lot of people in the past. I've gone to private schools. I've, you know, encountered different people who think that it's okay to make comments, insensitive comments about your race because they're joking. And they think that if they're joking and they say it in, you know, good-naturedly, that things will fly. So I just, again, I wanted to make just a nightmare character, a person who just went over the top with every race. So Amir is just that type of guy. He's that guy in The Office.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm speaking with the creator and star of the online sitcom, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, Issa Rae. You know, a lot of people feel like they're breaking new ground and talking about race, especially in comedy. But to other people, they're just being offensive. Where do you think is the line between actually breaking new ground and saying something funny and new and fresh and really calling it out and just being offensive in a new way?
It's a hard line, honestly, because even on my end, I've said some things in the show that people haven't approved of. And at the time, you know, you think it's funny because you may not go through it. You may not have gone through something. You might not understand what it is to walk in someone's shoes.
Clearly, though, people are responding. I mean, it's just by evidence of what happened on Kickstarter. Were you surprised by that?
Absolutely. It was just overwhelmingly positive. I didn't expect that many people. We almost had 2,000 people donate to this show. And just to think of how the show came about and how impulsive it was, the fact that so many people support it and that the show resonates with them is just amazing.
Well, tell me about that. You're saying how it came about, it was impulsive. Tell me what happened exactly?
Well, essentially, I knew I wanted to do the show. I was sitting on the idea for about 2 years, and I was in New York at the time, and I didn't really have any resources. I didn't know that many people, and my camera equipment had just been stolen. So I moved to L.A. and started working on another web series with my brother. And while doing that web series, I was like, okay, you know, I've been sitting on this character for way too long. Let me try to do it. And I wanted to make it an animated series initially, but animation costs a lot of money. So I just decided to shoot it myself and do it guerrilla style. And, you know, it was never written in advance. It's just a very impulsive decision.
That's funny. In your pitch on the fundraising site Kickstarter, you wrote about your frustration with the way black women are depicted on network television. You write, "I don't see myself or women like me being represented. I'm not a smooth, sexy, long-haired vixen. I'm not a large, sassy black woman, an angry post office employee. I'm an awkward black girl, and I'm not alone." I have to wonder, though, now with this success on the web and the fact that there are a lot of broadcast network television comedies that thrive on awkward characters, I wonder whether you think, you know, the network is next.
You know, sometimes I wonder if network TV is ready. We were producing the show or packaging the show to sell it to networks. And then we stopped and thought about it and thought about how, like, just the landscape for television now, and especially for black women, and it's just so bleak. So I think, you know, keeping it on the web right now and just building an audience there, we have so much freedom, we have so much creative control. That's just an ideal space for us right now.
So what's next for the awkward black girl? What else has she got going on?
Well, in the next episode, for example, she's tackling what to do when you have an overly religious coworker. So I know that that's going to be a sensitive topic because just in the black community, you know, religion is a huge topic. So, yeah, she's gonna grapple that space.
Well, we'll look forward to it. Issa Rae is the creator, director, and star of the online television series, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. And she joined us, not so awkwardly, from our studios at NPR West. Issa Rae, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Last night, Lil Wayne performed at the MTV Video Music Awards to promote his new album. It's out this week after being delayed repeatedly. Despite the wait, the rapper's fan base has only grown, thanks in part to his digital strategy. Nishat Kurwat has this profile of the high-tech mind behind Lil Wayne.
In some ways, Mazie Kazerouni is your typical tech startup prodigy. He left high school at age 17 to work for a live video streaming platform called Ustream.
Ustream gave me a very interesting perspective, because when you see how many viewers somebody can get on a live video stream, you can really understand how connected they are to their fans, how many they have, you know, like how much they love them, because it's a lot harder to get 10,000 people to watch you at the same time than it is to get 10,000 views on a YouTube video.
I let you buy, yeah.
He set out to lure big-name rappers like Lil Wayne into using the site to reach their fans.
Shout out to Mazie.
Then Kazerouni took up a little side hustle, working as Lil Wayne's digital consultant, helping grow the rapper's presence on social media platforms beyond Ustream.
He had a million fans sitting on his page, and no one had access to it. No one even really knew what Facebook was on his team. And I had to argue with them for like a month to give me the information I needed to get them the access.
He multiplied the number of fans on the page to 30 million in a little over a year.
Now there's a lot of attention being paid to what's going on online.
I heard entrepreneurial spirit being thrown around a lot as a phrase. I didn't really see an illustration of what that meant until I met Mazie. He has it.
Joanna Dorfman is the site editor at Ustream.tv, the startup that gave Kazerouni his first job. Kazerouni built buzz for the site by pursuing all kinds of celebrities, from bloggers to musicians, as some of its first users. He pumped up their live broadcasts on Ustream's Twitter feed. He'd slip into their chat rooms and offer tech support when they hit a glitch.
Oh, it's Mazie. Mazie's in the house.
You might not expect rappers to swoon over someone like Kazerouni, a baby-faced Persian American from Orange County who didn't grow up listening to rap. But in videos posted to their Ustream channels, popular rappers like Wiz Khalifa and Lil Bow Wow sing Kazerouni's praises.
From Ustream is in this room right now. He's gonna watch me eat this cup of noodles.
Mazie, man, you're like the Ustream Jesus, man. You just come out of nowhere and just come help every celebrity on their Ustream.
Arguably, the celebrity he's helped the most is his client Lil Wayne. As the Facebook page manager, Kazerouni strategically reposts Lil Wayne's Twitter commentary and also posts announcements about the rapper's whereabouts.
While he was in jail, we had an address so people could send him letters, and he'd write back letters to a bunch of these people. I would post all that stuff on Facebook, and we just kept everybody engaged throughout the whole process.
That active engagement proves those 30 million fans aren't idly watching the page, and this means the page is ripe for merchandising. Few of those posts contain product mentions, but the ones that do are moneymakers.
I do everything the management needs to make sure we're selling his products without bothering the fans.
Wayne's summer tour is promoted on his wall, mostly by name-checking cities. A shout-out, say, to Atlanta, can inspire some 7,000 comments. Wayne also hawks a brand of vanity cigars, and when Kazaruni occasionally posts about them on the page, local markets sell out. He even won the page a Guinness World Record, the most likes on a post in 24 hours. For NPR News, I'm Nishat Karwa.
Nishat Karwa reports for TurnstileNews.com, a project of Youth Radio. Today is the unofficial end of summer, so it seemed to us like a good day to pick the song of summer. NPR's Sammy Yenigun has taken into consideration measures objective and subjective, and he is ready to argue that the title this year should go to one huge hit, Rolling in the Deep by Adele.
There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch and it's bringing me out the dark.
Rolling in the Deep is this year's undisputed champion of the charts. It sold 4.8 million copies in the U.S., over a million more than the number two song.
See, I'll leave with every piece of you. Don't underestimate the things that I will do.
Released last November, it wasn't a major hit right off the bat. In February, around the time of her album's release, Adele started getting attention from mainstream pop culture platforms. She performed on Letterman, Glee did a cover of the song. And in May, the song shot to the top spot on the charts, where it stayed for 8 weeks straight.
The scars of your love, they leave me breathless. I can't help feeling we could have had it all.
But sales tell only a fraction of the success story. The video's been viewed over 121 million times on YouTube. YouTube Trends manager Kevin Alaka.
If you look at the chart of how the views sort of spread for that video, it wasn't until the summer that it really took off, as opposed to a lot of other really big videos that can start off big and then taper off, or sort of start off really big and then remain huge. It really grew gradually. So you can kind of see that over the summer is really when that video became popular.
YouTube views, sales, this is how we usually gauge a hit song. But Alaka says that what Adele's fans have done with the song is astounding.
If you search for Adele cover songs, you'll get about 15,000 results on YouTube of various things that are labeled as that. And several of those have over a million views. And those run the gamut from professional like Linkin Park to somebody like Mike Tompkins, who's a sort of a big star on YouTube, to there's a really great one that a band from the Air Force put out.
When Alaka drove up to Toronto this summer, he heard Rolling in the Deep on the radio a total of 10 times, with 4 different remixes of it. Part of the song's crossover appeal has been due to the amount of remix attention it's received. Liam Durlam, a producer who goes by the name Voodoo Farm, says that the original producer left a lot of room for remixers to put their own touches on it.
Every single DJ that has remixed Rolling in the Deep owes Rick Rubin a huge kiss on the lips, because he strips down songs and exposes the songs for what they are.
People who went to music festivals this summer likely heard the song over and over again in various shapes and sizes. Big-name DJs introduced thousands of electrified versions of the hit, and now everyone dances to it. For his own remix, Durlam took the minimal instrumentation of the original and added synthesizers and audio effects to create a dancier version of the song that he loves.
I fell in love with the song the second I heard it. I popped on the headphones, started jamming out, and about halfway through it, I was just like, this is the most beautiful song I've heard in the last 10 years.
Simply put, Rolling in the Deep is a heart-stopping, chart-topping, YouTube-popping, cover-propping, booty-dropping jam. The song of the summer. Sammy Yenigun, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Our podcast is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.